This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 11th, 2007. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Ada Bogado. Coming up in today's newscast, the U.S. Senate prepares for a vote of no confidence in Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. France's right wing gains momentum in parliamentary elections. And New York domestic workers demand a Bill of Rights. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals today ruled that the government cannot hold so-called enemy combatants without charge. Attorneys brought the case on behalf of a U.S. legal resident originally from Qatar who has been held in solitary confinement in a South Carolina Navy brig for the past 4 years. Judges ruled 2-1 today that the Military Commissions Act of 2006 cannot legally take away a detainee's right to challenge his or her detention. In other news, American military commanders in Iraq have begun to arm Sunni militants in Baghdad. Hiba Dawood has more.
The U.S. military has been arming Sunni tribesmen in the Anbar province for months, ostensibly to fight al-Qaeda. American commanders regard the program as a success because the Anbar province is no longer regarded as one of the most dangerous areas of Iraq. Now, U.S. forces want to apply the Anbar formula to Baghdad. But the critics of the program, including Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, fear that the weapons could worsen internal fighting and sectarian violence. Some of the groups have admitted to attacks against U.S. personnel in the past. The Iraqi press is reporting that some of the Sunni tribal leaders who have received weapons are now demanding positions in the Iraqi cabinet. The Iraqi Prime Minister has refused this demand. But these factions will likely gain more power if the U.S. military continues to arm them. For FSRN, this is Hiba Dawood.
A Washington Post study of judicial appointees to immigration courts has found that the Bush administration has consistently favored those with close ties to the Republican Party over candidates with experience or other professional qualifications. Immigration judges have traditionally been considered civil servants, and their political ties are not legally a factor in job placement. The Washington Post analysis found that since 2004, one half of the appointees lacked a background in immigration law, and one third were either Bush administration insiders or Republican Party loyalists. Family members of victims of paramilitary violence in Colombia have filed a lawsuit for damages against Chiquita Brands. From Bogota, Nicole Carson has more.
Lawyers from D.C.-based international rights advocates have filed a complaint in U.S. federal court for damages on behalf of 144 family members of Colombians murdered by illegally armed groups that received payoffs from Chiquita Brands. The U.S. food company admits to paying the armed groups that are on the U.S. list of terrorist organizations, but says that the payouts were to protect workers. Colombian Senator Gustavo Petro has revealed evidence that Chiquita Brands not only supplied revenue to the AUC paramilitaries, but that the company worked with the paramilitary group to export cocaine and import arms disguised as banana shipments. Senator Petro calculates that Chiquita paid the AUC some $14 million, much more than the $1.7 million to which Chiquita has admitted. Approximately 2,500 assassinations took place between 1997 and 1999 in the region of Uruba, where Chiquita was paying the paramilitaries. Lawyers from international rights advocates plan to add more victims to this suit, which could end up costing Chiquita Brands much more than the $25 million fine they have already been ordered to pay. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nicole Carson in Bogota.
Two Lebanese Red Cross workers were killed and a Palestinian sheikh was wounded today as fighting between the Lebanese army and a Sunni Islamist group holed up in a Palestinian refugee camp enters its third week. Which side fired the shell that killed the Red Cross workers today remains unclear. Pakistan's Supreme Court has begun to examine allegations brought by a former top judge that the corruption charges pending against him are politically motivated. The judge's removal has sparked widespread discontent among attorneys and judges alike. Devon Terrior reports from Islamabad.
In a setback to Pakistan's President General Pervez Musharraf, Pakistan's Supreme Court has moved to the merits of ousted Chief Justice Iftikhar Muhammad Chaudhry's claim challenging his removal. Lawyers representing the government of Pakistan had hoped to get the charges thrown out of court. Instead, the court's decision will permit Chaudhry's legal team to inquire into the government's motives in filing corruption charges against him. Chaudhry is the first Chief Justice in Pakistan's history to refuse a request by the executive to resign from his post. Chaudhry's supporters believe that the corruption charges were principally motivated by Chaudhry's decisions against the government in privatization and missing persons cases. In a related development, a lawyer representing the government of Pakistan stated today that fresh corruption charges may be filed against Chaudhry arising from his speaking tour of Pakistan's bar associations in support of judicial independence. A decision on the original corruption charges is expected by July. For FSRN, this is Devon Terrier Orr in Islamabad, Pakistan.
And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
This evening, the U.S. Senate will consider a resolution of no confidence in Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Several Republicans have joined the Democrats in expressing grave concern about his ability to lead the Department of Justice, and some have even called for his resignation. But most GOP lawmakers are unlikely to support a vote of no confidence. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Alberto Gonzalez has been embroiled in public skepticism for his policy since September 11, 2001. As President Bush's White House counsel, Gonzalez authored the so-called torture memo. It said the U.S. did not have to comply with the Geneva Conventions on the treatment of detainees. Gonzalez also okayed the removal of habeas corpus for detainees. Also as White House counsel, he advised the president to push ahead with the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping program. Just last month, former Deputy Attorney General James Comey revealed that Gonzalez was one of the men who pressured then-Attorney General John Ashcroft to approve the wiretapping program while he was recovering from surgery in his hospital bed. And as Attorney General, Gonzalez's Department of Justice has been alleged with focusing on voter fraud involving Democratic candidates instead of voter disenfranchisement, and for the politicizing of the Civil Rights Division. And Monday, the Washington Post reported the political hiring of one-third of the immigration judges. But the scandal that has resulted in an effort by the Senate Democrats to issue a sentiment of no confidence is the firings of at least 8 U.S. attorneys, only to be replaced by Bush Party loyalists. Lisa Graves is with the Center for National Security Studies. She says Gonzalez has proven his loyalty lies with the Bush administration.
I think that it's really stunning in a number of ways how Gonzalez has been at the center of the erosion of the rule of law in this country.
That loyalty has boded well for Gonzalez in one way. The president is standing behind him. He denounced the Democrats' attack during a news conference Monday in Bulgaria.
They haven't said here is you've done something wrong, Attorney General Gonzalez. And therefore, I ascribe this lengthy series of news stories and hearings is political.
The Senate vote won't determine his employment at Justice, says Tim Lynch, director of the Project of Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute.
Well, the vote in the Senate today does not have any binding quality to it. If the Senate goes ahead and votes no confidence in Alberto Gonzalez, President Bush does not have to fire him. The president retains the option of keeping him on.
But beyond the president, support for Gonzalez is hard to find. In the past 3 months, about a dozen Republicans have publicly expressed deep concern about the honesty and ability of Gonzalez, including Tom Coburn of Oklahoma.
Mr. Attorney General, you set the standard. You said leadership skills, management skills, they were sorely lacking in this instance. And the responsibility is to start with a clean slate, a new set of leadership skills, a new set of management skills to heal this in the country, to restore the confidence.
And here's Bush ally Jeff Sessions of Alabama.
Well, I guess I'm concerned about your recollection, really.
But not all criticism expressed will translate into a vote of no confidence. Many Republicans are unwilling to support the Democrats, calling it a political ploy, and they're wary about opposing the president. But one key Republican says he will vote no confidence. Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania speaking on the Senate floor Monday.
The interest of the country and moving for improvements in the Department of Justice is to make a candid statement that I have no confidence in the Attorney General, which I have said repeatedly, it's no surprise, and I'm going to deal with this resolution on the merits and vote to invoke cloture.
But Cato's Tim Lynch says that despite the outcome, the vote could have broad implications on Gonzalez's ability to work with Capitol Hill.
If he wants certain legal legislation passed to the Congress, the senators are basically saying that, you know, they don't have much confidence in his statements, his explanations, and his justifications for a wide variety of the Bush administration's policies. It's another indication that his standing on Capitol Hill is just as low as it can be.
Despite the outcome, congressional Democrats promise further investigations into various aspects of the DOJ. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Sri Lankan President Ratnasiri Wickramanayake apologized for evicting hundreds of ethnic Tamils from the capital, Colombo, promising there would be no repeat of the controversial operation. FSRN's Ponia Manikavasakam reports on the aftermath.
Sri Lankan police last week expelled more than 300 ethnic Tamils from low-budget Colombo hostels, reasoning they posed a serious threat to the security of the capital. They were bused to the vault on northeastern parts of the island with an armed police escort. Foreign governments and rights groups openly criticized the government for the expulsion, while the police justified it as a step to prevent the infiltration of the rebels into the city. Nearly 200 were sent to a detention center in the northernmost border town of Vaunia, about 160 miles from Colombo. The others went back to eastern Sri Lanka. Following a Supreme Court order to stop the eviction, the police took those in detention back to Colombo the next day. Pumani Rajaratnam is a resident of Jaffna and had gone to Colombo with a son to send him to a Middle East country to be employed.
The police came and forced us to get into the bus. They did not even allow me to finish the tea I was drinking. There is no employment in Jaffna, no cement, no building materials, and we have no job there. I will not go back home until I attend to the travel purposes of my son.
Prime Minister Ratnasiri Wickramanayake told reporters the expulsion of Tamils from Colombo was a big mistake and expressed regret over the police action. He said the government is considering compensation to the victims. Noel Navanidhan is employed in Malaysia. He had come to Colombo few days ago on a month's leave and was staying in one of the hostels where the police conducted the raid.
When the police forced us into the bus, we thought we were being deported. They didn't ask us anything. We are the citizens of this country, but they brought us here in an inhuman way. It's a total violation of our rights.
Security in the capital was tightened after 9 civilians were killed and more than 40 were recently injured in 2 separate rebel bomb attacks that took place in and around the capital. Since then, the Ministry of Defense, in a statement, warned ethnic Tamils staying in the hostels that anybody staying in Colombo without valid reason would be expelled. Center for Policy Alternative, a civil rights group, challenged police actions in the Supreme Court. Attorney at law, Nadraja Sumandran, filed the petition.
After hearing submission, Supreme Court was satisfied. This was a grave breach of humanitarian law and also a violation of the fundamental rights of these people. And so immediately granted a stay order preventing the police from evacuating any more people. And also they gave an interim order restraining the police from stopping anybody from northeast coming into the city.
Sumandran said the court will hear the human rights violation case. In its effort to crush the Tamil Tiger rebels, the Sri Lankan government is now forced to face serious allegations of violating human rights. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiya Manikavasagam from Vaunia, Sri Lanka.
Hundreds of nannies and caregivers marched in New York over the weekend to call for state lawmakers to pass a domestic workers' bill of rights. Currently, domestic workers, who are mostly immigrant women of color, are written out of most standard labor laws. But there is a new movement spurred by the workers themselves to change that. Christine Lewis of the Community News Production Institute reports from New York City.
Over the weekend, hundreds of domestic workers marched on the streets of Manhattan, demanding basic labor protections.
We're building power. We're raising the level of respect for domestic work. We're working to establish fair labor standards and helping to build the movement for justice and equality for all.
Aijin Pu is an organizer with Domestic Workers United, an organization made up of domestic workers throughout the New York region. Domestic workers are not protected by most labor laws, including OSHA, the Fair Labor Standard Act, and the National Labor Relations Act. Deborah Cole is a nanny who was fired by her employer just last week.
I was sick and needed surgery. Even though I had a discussion with my employer initially before I even had the surgery, I had someone hold on for me for the week vacation that I requested. And after my surgery and my vacation was up, I called them and asked and told them that I would be coming in to work on Monday. When I went to receive my salary, I was given 1 week severance pay after my surgery. I was also told that they no longer needed my services.
Domestic workers are primarily immigrant women of color from Southeast Asia, the Caribbean, Africa, and Latin America. These women work as nannies, housekeepers, elderly caregivers, and even dog walkers. They work long hours for little pay. Joyce Campbell is also a nanny and a leader amongst the domestic workers.
Only about 2 months ago, we lost one of our workers, one of our sisters, working on 72nd Street. She was cleaning the windows of her boss's home, and she fell to her death while cleaning those windows. When the boss was asked by the police what happened, she said she did not tell her to clean the windows. Sisters, this is what we face today. We face the abuse and exploitation within this industry. We face slavery.
The Domestic Worker Bill of Rights that is being considered in the New York State Legislature would require a living wage of at least $12 per hour, overtime pay, health care, and vacation time. Opponents of the bill say any attempt to mandate wages, benefits, and working conditions for a large number of entry-level workers will only result in fewer jobs. Assemblymember Keith Wright, a co-sponsor of the bill, addressed the concerns that critics have.
When you have 200,000 folks working in private homes that spur the economy, that are the backbone of the economy, especially in the state of New York State, they deserve to be singled out.
Boom, boom. I said down with slavery.
Boom, boom.
And exploitation.
Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I am Christine Lewis with the Community News Production Institute.
The first round of France's legislative election yesterday leaves the mainstream right-wing party, the UMP, well ahead of its left-wing rivals. Following the victory of Nicolas Sarkozy in last month's presidential race, the party looks set to win a clear majority in the National Assembly in next Sunday's second round. Tony Cross has more from Paris.
The socialist faithful put on a brave show today as failed presidential candidate Ségolène Royal stomps for the party's parliamentary hopefuls in Paris. But all the left-wing parties together only won 40% of the vote against the right's 45.5%. And the way the constituencies are drawn up means an even lower share of seats in the Assembly. The left is expected to get a maximum of 185 seats, while the right can expect a minimum of 383. Nevertheless, Royal put in a bid for the votes of François Bayrou, the former right-wing minister who has criticised Sarkozy and set up a new party, the Democratic Movement, or MoDem.
It's very important that the electors of François Bayrou.
It's very important that François Bayrou's voters support the candidates of the left, of progress, and that we do the same when a Democratic Movement candidate can win.
but there aren't that many Bayrou voters to win over. His 18% score in the presidential election looks as if it was a one-minute wonder. His new party only gained 8% yesterday. Bayrou last night said that his party had been drowned in a wave of support for the UMP.
That creates a heavy imbalance in representation in the National Assembly. And sooner or later, France will regret that imbalance. It's not healthy to have institutions, which will probably give a record number of seats to one side, and only offers the other a reduced representation. Obviously, too small to mean that there's equilibrium in the Assembly.
In contrast to the huge turnout in the presidential election, this poll saw a record low turnout of 60%. But it's unlikely that the demoralized left will be able to revitalize its disillusioned supporters for the second round next weekend. But there was one bigger loser yesterday, the far-right National Front. It scored its lowest vote since the 1980s, at only 4%, a derisory score compared to front leader Jean-Marie Le Pen's 17% in the 2002 presidential poll. Sarkozy's strategy of adopting much of the far-right's rhetoric on immigration and crime seems to have paid off. Meanwhile, Sarkozy is moving forward on his agenda. Now his Prime Minister, François Fillon, promises immediate action on education, limiting the right to strike, and crime.
Dès l'été, nous engagerons aussi la réforme de nos universités.
This summer, we will start reforming our universities. We will introduce a service minimum in the transport system. We will legislate on law and order so as to end the feeling of impunity. Our decisions are ready. They scrupulously honor Nicolas Sarkozy's campaign promises. But all that's just the beginning.
Fillon went on to promise changes in the labor market, a summit on the environment, and action to reduce the public deficit. The right has already decided to slash taxes for the super-rich, allow tax-free overtime working, and introduce tax relief for home buyers. So either other state revenue is somehow going to soar, or public spending cuts look likely somewhere along the line. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
Residents in the town of Felton, California, are using eminent domain to buy back their water supply from a private water company called American Water. Residents complain of price gouging and poor customer service. FSRN's Christina Anistad reports.
The small community of Felton is going toe-to-toe with the nation's largest private water company. American Water serves some 18 million customers in 29 states. 82-year-old Milton Nielsen lives on Social Security with his son in Felton, California. After a water pipe broke on his property, he received a water bill for over $4,000.
I got that bill and I almost fell over.
After complaining to American Water about his bill, they agreed to cut the bill in half, requiring Nielsen to pay over $2,000 for water he never used.
I wouldn't have asked them to give me a hand if I was dying of thirst in the desert. That's how crooked these people are.
Nielsen says his last water bill was $162, more than double what he paid before American Water bought the system in 2002. This steep increase is why the community of Felton has now voted overwhelmingly to buy their water system back. But the company refuses to sell. Kevin Tilden, spokesperson for Cal-M Water, American Water's California division, says price increases are necessary to maintain the decades-old water system.
Water standards are changing for water quality. The EPA standards are changing, and there's some investment needed to keep up with that. But also, water systems are generally 40 to 100 years old, and there's just a certain amount of maintenance and replacement needed to keep them reliable and current.
Tilden says the company's prices are comparable to those in nearby water districts and actually lower than some, like the community of Davenport, where residential water bills are over $1,000 every year. The San Lorenzo Water District shares the same water source as Felton. Barbara Springer, a member of Felton's Flow, Friends of Locally Owned Water, says SLV's water rates are half what she pays American Water.
For me here, where we have two houses on one bill, for 40 units, for SLV Water District, you'd be paying about $118 for 2 months. For Cal-Am, we're paying $275 for the same amount of water.
The people of Felton plan to use eminent domain to buy back their water system, but American Water has spent millions resisting. Springer says the rate increases are not going to pay for maintenance, but to pay for American Water's corporate overhead.
SOV Water District is managed right here in the San Lorenzo Valley. That's it. Cal-Am has a layer of management in Monterey, California, a layer of management in Voorhees, New Jersey. They have another layer then in Essen, Germany. So we're paying for all those multiple layers and significant private corporate salaries.
Felton isn't the only community to battle American Water. The city of Chicago waited months for broken fire hydrants to be fixed. And communities in Ohio fought back rate increases for brown tap water from American Water. Victoria Kaplan of Food and Water Watch says there's a conflict with private companies owning public resources like water.
Private water companies are accountable to their shareholders, not to the communities that they serve.
Last year, American Water's parent company, German-based RWE, announced it was selling American Water in order to focus on energy. But Food and Water Watch released RWE board meeting minutes that show American Water estimates it will take over 200 years to replace its faulty infrastructure, and its outdated pipe system is leaking nearly 20 to 30% of water in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. The minutes also state that regulations on arsenic and mercury contamination are getting tougher to meet, suggesting that RWE is selling American Water to offload a potential liability. RWE declined to comment for this feature. Meanwhile, the community of Felton and American Water have their first eminent domain court hearing later this month. From Felton, California, I'm Christina Onnested, reporting for FSRN.
Clashes between Fatah and Hamas left 3 dead and at least 50 injured today in the Gaza Strip. The violence follows Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's announcement Sunday that military operations in the Gaza Strip will be ongoing if Palestinian rocket fire and, quote, terror attempts continue to threaten neighboring Israeli settlements. Meanwhile, hundreds of anti-war activists gathered in Washington, D.C. Sunday to mark the 40th anniversary of Israel's military occupation of the Palestinian territories. Sponsored by United for Peace and Justice and the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, organizers of the 2-day-long mobilization said it was the first of its kind at the Capitol. Amongst nearly 20 other speakers was Assam El-Nunu, co-founder of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program.
I came here to you today from Gaza, the biggest prison in the surface of Earth, where people are suffering the utmost a human being can tolerate. The occupation, the intimidation, the siege, the impoverishment. But they tell you a clear message that we are there to stay and we are not giving up our rights.
Events continued today with a grassroots lobbying day on Capitol Hill. Groups are calling for an end to U.S. economic, diplomatic, and military support of the Israeli occupation and a new foreign policy plan that will lead to peace between Israelis and Palestinians. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Auda Bogado.